we're about to meet two fascinating detectives who happen to be women. In fact, we'll recognize their names, Holmes and Watson. We'll observe their relationship and be drawn into the way they work in the upcoming theatrical presentation by Hamilton Gibson Productions in Wellsboro. Here's what we learn about those we might call their sisters. Actually, Frank Kestner, a scholar, calls them Sherlock sisters in a study he created. And we hear this from Elizabeth Carolyn Miller. She writes, C.L. or Catherine Louisa Perkis has a book, The Murder at Troitz Hill, the second in her series of stories about Detective Loveday Brooke. And that begins with Brooke's boss debriefing her on a case. Griffiths of the Newcastle Constabulary has the case in hand. Those Newcastle men are keen-witted, shrewd fellows, and very jealous of outside interference. They only sent to me under protest, as it were, because they wanted your sharp wits at work inside the house. This is a typical beginning for one of Brooke's adventures, which were published in the London magazine Ludgate Monthly in 1893 and 1894. As one of the earliest professional female detectives in English literary history, Brooke's career was marked by conflicts with territorial male officers and the ever-present pressure to keep her detective work inside the house. Emerging at an historical moment when understandings of women, criminality, and law enforcement were rapidly changing in Britain, the stories by Perkis offer an interpretation of these intersecting cultural shifts that is surprisingly different from her contemporaries. In a decade rife with scientific interrogation into the nature of criminality, detective fiction of the 1890s tended to mimic scientific discourse in its representations of criminals. The Brooke stories, however, challenge such conceptions of deviance and reveal the poverty of their underlying understandings of crime as well as gender. Perkis was not the first or only Victorian author to write about a professional female detective. In the 1890s, amidst a general surge in the popularity and production of detective fiction, a number of so-called lady detectives began to appear in the pages of Victorian periodicals. Kathleen Klein calculates that between 1890 and 1910, at least 12 different novels featuring lady detectives were published. Perkis's work, though, stands out among these for several reasons. Loveday Brooke is a truly professional woman detective, not a woman forced into amateur detection to avenge her husband, as in Wilkie Collins' The Law and the Lady, nor a helpful sidekick. Brooke is paid for what she does, and though she may find pleasure in the thrill of her occupation, the primary motivation behind her detective work is to be paid. Several other 1890s lady detectives were also professional, but all except Brooke were involved in detection for acceptably feminine reasons, such as clearing a wrongfully accused fiancé or supporting a maimed husband no longer able to work. Moreover, Brooke was one of the first, if not the first, woman detectives to come from the pen of a woman author. Perkis was well established in her profession by the time she wrote the Brooke stories, having already written 13 novels and countless magazine stories. With Brooke, she turned for the first time to the popular genre of the detective story, which she reinvents as a feminist form within the pages of a mass-market Victorian magazine. Now, we learn from the scholar Frank Kestner, who calls his featured characters Sherlock's sisters, that the challenging aspect for the creators of the female detective is summarized in this way. The real difficulty for them in creating a woman detective had more to do with literary patterns and expectations than it had to do with real life. The problem was the fact that the detective in the classic detective story was the typical hero. According to the pattern established by Conan Doyle with Sherlock Holmes, he is also an almost superhuman mastermind who is allowed a great degree of eccentricity and egocentricity because of his extraordinary powers. With such forebears, what would women writers do? How would they approach it? The central point is that there were models of female independence and daring in numerous texts at that time, even if they were not detective stories, which could serve these writers, both male and female, in creating their intrepid female investigators. One can think of a range of proto-models, women both good and bad, such as protagonists of George Eliot's The Mill on the Floss, or Thomas Hardy's Far from the Madding Crowd, or The Return of the Native. Critics such as Elaine Showalter have demonstrated that the female protagonist in the sensation novel displayed a deft intelligence in confronting circumstances, provoking in readers fantasies of empowerment. Novels such as those by Hardy create protagonists who defy the patriarchal constraints imposed upon them. Whatever their value as escapism, the higher forms of the sensation novel are also in the business of crusading for social or political reform. Kestner continues that intelligence, self-assertion, daring, and defiance marked a range of female protagonists in English fiction before the creation of Sherlock Holmes. These traits distinguish Holmes' adversary, Irene Adler, though, in the first Holmes short story, A Scandal in Bohemia, published in The Strand in July 1891. The fact that Holmes is not superhuman, but is rather defeated by Irene Adler, gave the opening to create the female detectives who became his sisters in the detective tradition. Hamilton Gibson Productions will present Miss Holmes Returns by Christopher M. Walsh this weekend and next at the Warehouse Theater in Wellsboro. This is a sequel to Miss Holmes, which Hamilton Gibson performed to acclaim in 2019. And we had a chance to speak by Zoom with Gabe Hakvak, who is director, and the actors Nikki York, who has the role of Sherlock Holmes, and Sarah Elswick, who plays Dr. Dorothy Watson, about the show and about Hamilton Gibson Productions.
Hamilton Gibson Productions is a local community performance arts group. It was created to empower our community with opportunities in performance. That includes music, singing. We have a number of choirs. We have youth drama camps. And then we have our stage productions, which can be short little one-weekend runs, usually aligned with a local festival. And then our main stage productions, which would include this year, Miss Holmes Returns. We're the resident artists at the Warehouse Theater, which is part of the Dean Center for the Performing Arts. So we are in that space pretty much all the time, but on occasion we'll take a bigger show or a musical to some other venues in our area, including last summer we did Joseph and his amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat up at the Strawn Theater at Commonwealth of Pennsylvania Mansfield.
That is a full array of theatrical and musical offerings that you're engaged in. I think you've been doing it for a very long time, haven't you?
35th year.
35th, that's it.
Gabe, introduce us to the actors, and then we'll talk about the production.
Oh, my goodness. So in 2019, the committee that screens and reads plays and offers feedback to our artistic director, Thomas Putnam, put forward a play called Miss Holmes by a playwright named Christopher Walsh, retelling of the Conan Doyle Holmes stories with the idea that what if Sherlock and Dr. Watson were women, particularly Victorian-era women? How would that change in the story? And I put my hand up to direct it, mostly because of the challenge of that was a play with over 20 different locations. And someone in the committee said, oh, we could never do this. There's too many scene changes. And I went, oh, hold my beer. I can make that happen. So sometimes you read a play and you're completely blown away. Other times you read a play and like, okay, I get it. This works, blah, blah, blah. That was kind of where I was until we started rehearsing Miss Holmes. And actually, even before that, when we auditioned for Miss Holmes, we had 3 days of auditions scheduled. Bunch of people came. The first people to read were Nikki and Sarah, who just so utterly blew away the relationship in an intuitive manner that several people there just went, well, we're done here, aren't we? And I went, oh, no, we're going to go through the process. But in my mind, I'm like, oh, crap, yep, this is who it's going to be. So I've worked with Nikki and Sarah on a number of projects. I've directed both of them many times, and they've collaborated with me on other projects. They're wonderful artists who, like me, also have full-time jobs and responsibilities. So they're just great. I was very glad. So when Miss Holmes Returns became available for production, my first chore was I went to all of the returning characters and asked each of the actors if they would be interested in doing this. And so Sarah and Nikki were the first ones I gave the script to, said, I don't want to do this without you. Read this and tell me if you're interested. And they were both like, heck yeah. So so there we are.
Did you know for round one, Nikki and Sarah, did you know the piece?
I did not know the piece until I had read it when it was presented. But it spoke to me. I'm very interested in women's rights and privileges. And so I wanted to be a part of this no matter what. I had no idea that I would be Sherlock Holmes, and I was completely caught off guard when I was offered the role. I couldn't say no to it. It was such a big part of my life at that point, and just in terms of women's rights.
And Sarah, what drew you round one?
Sherlock Holmes is such an iconic character, as well as Dr. Watson. And so I am always somebody who loves when gender flipping happens. I had written a play for Hamilton Gibson, a short 10-minute thing where I switched moms and dads roles. So men were playing the roles of moms. So that's always sort of been an interest of mine. So I wanted to go out and see if I could have some part in it in some way. I didn't know Nikki very well then, but we happened to go on the same day. And I had so much fun auditioning with her that it was kind of a little magical for sure.
Without spoiling, give us a premise for the number one play, and then take us to what you can safely say about the second play, The Return.
Well, what I admire about Christopher Walsh's writing is that while this definitely embraces the world of Sherlock Holmes, it's not stuck with that. It's not like, oh, we have to have this, and then this person has to come, and then this thing has to happen. You know, it respects, you know, the lore, but it is not owned by it. And the idea of the switching of the genders of the main characters, he backs up with a tremendous amount of historical research, bringing real political figures, real laws, real situations from that period. So, for instance, in Miss Holmes, Holmes is committed into a mental asylum by her brother Mycroft because he did not approve of her behavior. And as the eldest male in the family, he had the legal authority to do so. So if Miss Holmes was about the birth of the relationship between Holmes and Watson, thrown together, embroiled in a very dangerous investigation that becomes more dangerous as they get closer and closer to finding the who's and the what's. It also expanded that context of what was happening in the world around them. And by the play's end, Watson has gone through this sort of transformation where she's kind of come to terms with her own abilities and power, as well as understanding that her place in society is going to be a bit dicey because of this unusual relationship she has. So that's leaving all the mystery whodunit details out of it, which were certainly there. You know, that was kind of the heart of that story. So in Miss Holmes Returns, we're picking up 5 years later, and they have been working as consulting detectives, helping people that no one else will help, while at the same time bankrolled and secretly supported by Mycroft Holmes, because Mycroft is aware that there is some organization and or persons that seems to be controlling almost all criminal activity in London. And obviously, as a representative of Her Majesty's government, he wants this person stopped. So they're working for Mycroft while also providing the services that they provide. And so this mysterious figure they're looking for is known as the Professor. And they found his money man, the person who launders his funds, and are on their way to arrest / interrogate him with Inspector Lestrade, and they find him dead. Dun, dun,
dun. What did you find, Nikki, in developing a Holmes-like character who is representing something different in the fact that it's Ms. Holmes? Does that temper what we might think of as Sherlock? In what ways?
Well, in the first one, in both of them, really, Sherlock Holmes' character still has that arrogance, the arrogance that goes along with all of the knowledge and the skill that she has and what she thinks she has. The difference is that she's bankrolled by her brother, so she doesn't really have a lot of control. But on the other hand, she has a lot of skill, and she does have the respect of her brother. And you realize that as you get further and further through the script. She has the respect of her brother. And in the first one, you can see that she's had to fight against the societal norms. She shouldn't be able to have the freedom that she has, that she is not expected to have the skill or the knowledge that she has. But she doesn't really care at that point. Sherlock Holmes doesn't have a lot of emotional maturity. And what we see, what I see in the script and in this Miss Holmes Returns is that the 4 years that she has had with Dr. Watson has taught her about emotions and has brought her around to understanding and actually being able to maybe recognize and feel the emotions, not only in herself, but in others. And then that helps her be a better investigator, a better detective. And she wouldn't be able to do that without the life that she has led the last 4 years with Watson.
And then, Sarah, as Dr. Watson, again, the question of your character on your own.
Yeah, so one thing I really like about this version of Holmes and Watson is that it feels a lot more collaborative. Watson is a capable and intelligent character, not just a foil for Sherlock to bounce ideas and solutions off of. In the first play, Watson has the most growth between the two. She started as a resident in a women's hospital with a mentor, and she has had to walk an unconventional path to become a doctor, because women typically weren't. They reference something called the Surgeon's Hall Riot, where women were attacked with refuse and shouted at and tried to bar from taking their exams. That is a real historic event. And so what happens is she comes across Holmes, who is also living an unconventional life in Victorian London and directly helping people. And that intrigues her. And by the end of that play, she is fully into helping Sherlock as well as working at the hospital. Now, 4 years later, she's left the hospital because she doesn't agree with some of the practices there. And I think that she has grown into a confident person, both in her medical knowledge, which was true before, but also in who she is and the kind of effect she can have on the world. And a lot of that is because Holmes is so brilliant and trusts her. So the give and take between the two of them, I think, has allowed both of them to grow.
The theme of trust being built, trust being broken, is a pretty important one in Miss Holmes Returns. And to my mind, one of the ways that Holmes shows the most change is that prior, that would not have hit her the same way, because she did not open herself to relationships where having her trust betrayed would hurt her. You know, her brother threw her in an insane asylum. That's what he does. Then he let me out. Okay. Remember the line. Remember we agreed. No sentiment. And that's, I think, a thing that has slowly begun to change for Holmes, thanks to her relationship with Watson.
To what extent do we feel that we are in Victorian England? Dress, elevated speech, setting?
That's a great question. I mean, you know, so the Warehouse Theater is a small, intimate black box. There's a lot of locations here, and we don't have fly rails and big wings. So a great deal of it is suggested. But, you know, when you walk in the theater, you're going to see the skyline along the River Thames. You're going to see gas lights and brick walls and everything else is just sort of suggested for the audience. The costumes are period specific. Christopher Walsh, I think he does pretty well in his dialogue. It feels right. But again, he's not a slave to, okay, well, it has to be this way. He does what works, which is, again, his writing is subtle. When you hear it and hear it and hear it, like we've been doing for the last 3 months, I really begin to realize just how clever he's been in what he's created in this. But yeah, to answer your question, yeah, you'll know you're there. But we ask our audiences to build the show with us and bring their imagination and kind of fill in the gaps with us.
What about humor? There's wit and clever is the word you just used there, Gabe. But do we laugh with you two?
I'm going to say that you're going to laugh with us because we find a lot of humor. The connection between Watson and Holmes is really interesting now because they've had so much history. They can have their side glances and make their comments, you know, back and forth between them. But then also some of the antics are silly enough that you'll be laughing.
What about the repartee then? Do we have moments where you are going back and forth with each other in a way?
Yeah, I like to describe their relationship now as kind of an odd couple relationship. There's definitely some dialogue that suggests that there are conversations we're kind of sparring back and forth about things we've talked about many times before. Even in the first play, Sherlock discovers that Watson, you know, in her youth, wrote a book under a pseudonym, and she thinks her writing is terrible. And that theme comes back up in this show as well. So entertaining bits and pieces, and part of that is on us to develop.
So you were right, Gabe, to offer these parts to the Holmes and Watson of the past, because in fact, they do bring that history to
exactly
Returns,
right? Yeah. When we were mounting Miss Holmes, it was clear that the potential for a sequel was in the play and how it ended. I'm pretty sure we ended with the end question mark, because so I took a gamble. I was like, yeah, this is going to happen. And sure enough, you contacted the playwright. Yes, indeed. He was working on a sequel. It was commissioned for a theater company in Chicago, so that it had to be produced there first. Then he promised to let us know when it became available. Well, it's supposed to come out in 2020, but the world had other plans. So it took a few years later before the premiere, and then at that point, the rights became available. But so that entire time, I kept checking back in with Christopher Waltz. I think he's kind of tired of me at this point, because every 6 months to a year, I'd send him another email. But it was definitely going to happen. And I was excited back when the idea is we could have done it a year later. That would have been marvelous, right? But, you know, we'll take what we can get.
You no doubt, Gabe, because you're a veteran, have directed many a mystery. What about making it work? We don't want to get too far ahead of the characters so that we're saying, oh, yeah, we knew that. I mean, how do you keep that pace going?
Yeah. Well, last summer, even before I started seriously working on this production, I did revisit some of my favorite Sherlock Holmes presentations. Yeah, so, you know, the BBC's Adventures of Sherlock Holmes from the 80s and 90s, I checked out a few of those. Of course, Sherlock with Benedict Cumberbatch and Martin Freeman, and some of the Basil Rathbone ones. And so one of the things to remember about Holmes is it's not a whodunit, because there's no way the audience has any hope of following the clues, right? So it's a how do we figure it out is how Holmes stories work. So there's that element. You've got Sherlock rattling things off, bam, 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 bam. So a lot of the tension, a lot of the action is actually dialogue. So we spent a lot of time, really looking at the dialogue, writing. We spent a month just table reading, just because not only were we trying to figure out the characters and the new characters that come in and what the relationships are, but also what is the sword fighting that's happening here? Where is Sherlock setting a trap versus where is Sherlock blindsided? And so as a director, my job is to make sure those beats are there and that the audience can follow them. So that's a big part of it. Of course, you always want to make sure you don't make it too easy. You know, for Miss Holmes, Lilith's son, Gabe, figured it out like in the first act. He just let that lady look suspicious. and he turned to his dad and said, that lady's suspicious. And then she was bad guy. So yeah, you think about those kind of things, but you also don't want to cheat, right? It's like, hey, maybe our audience is smart. Maybe they can keep up. What's interesting in this particular play is Miss Holmes is actually blindsided. That's not a big spoiler. It's just to keep things a little interesting. So there are several surprises through the course of the story, one of which is, speaking of humor, is pretty hilarious because one person basically says things that indicate that what we've believed up to this point isn't, in fact, what happened.
And so Walsh writes Nikki and Sarah in a way that you can feel those beats with Gabe watching on and saying, yep, you got it, nailed it, that kind of thing. So it is a well-crafted piece so that you don't have to fudge.
Yes, it's definitely a well-crafted piece. And I enjoyed reading it several times and trying to get a little bit more meaning out of each time. But primarily having Gabe help tell where those beats are for me personally is the most important thing, really, having a director who can help you follow through there.
I really enjoy the table read portion of both the last play and this one, because to me it feels like English class in college, which I always enjoyed. We're sharing our theories about who is thinking what and when, and that really informs what we do later on the stage, facial expressions, tone of voice, that sort of thing. Finding the motivations for all the characters really sets a solid groundwork for us, I believe.
And then you have the beautiful moments when we're running a scene and all of a sudden somebody will, I could see the light bulb go off and they're like, wait a second, I actually think this is what's happening here. And they shift, same lines, same dialogue, and kapow, completely changes the scene. It's a beautiful thing to observe. We have a really good cast for the show, Erica, but you know, finding people who are alive to that kind of discovery and rehearsal as a community theater is wonderful. I mean, most of the cast, you know, have never been trained in acting. Some maybe somewhat, or they've just done enough plays that then they kind of get how it works. But you know, these are not Juilliard trained method actors, but they are willing to try things. And they'll tell you, I keep throwing, hey, what about this? What if this happened? You know, or sometimes director's tricks like, that's great, but why don't you say it with your hands down at your side, clenched into fists? See what I can get.
All of the new cast members are great. One, Ty, who plays Olive McGann. This is her first time on the Hamilton Gibson stage. And then we got Mukta. He's playing Priya Singh, and she came in from New York City. Thank goodness. She's a wonderful actress. We've had one full week with her. You know, everybody has been wonderful and so talented.
This is a great opportunity to bring up two other interesting things about the show. I mentioned that Christopher Walsh likes to weave in a lot of actual history. And for this play, the historical person, Josephine Butler, here is a character. Butler was an activist, was a political activist fighting for women's rights in that time period, and particularly worked hard to repeal the Infectious Diseases Act, which was a law that allowed the police to hold in custody any woman who has been accused of spreading a social disease, you might say, which meant to a whole lot of women in prison for a whole long time, their lives upended because of an accusation. So that's a big part of the plot of this show. Another part is the character Priya Singh, who is a nurse who works for Josephine Butler. She is a fictitious character. Obviously, by the name Singh, you can tell she is of Indian descent. Specifically, her parents were from Bombay. They came to England after a deadly riot at the East India Tea Company, coming in with troops and putting down this rebellion. So she's an English woman. As she says, I'm as English as any of you, but because of the way she looks, she is treated as a foreigner. And that is another important thread in the plot that works its way out throughout the program. When I agreed to direct the show, I knew I needed to find an Indian actor. And, you know, where we live, it's not a very diverse area. There's diversity here. Don't hear that the wrong way. But it's not like we already had in our company a variety of people to choose from. So there was a bit of a gamble. Would we be able to find someone? And, well, I tracked down and spoke to a whole lot of people of Indian descent in Tioga County. I also spoke to some folks with Iranian descent. I was kind of scoping out East Asia and South Asia as possibilities for Priya. Talked to a lot of folks who were intrigued by the idea, but life, this, that, just wasn't the right time for them. So Casey Hagen, who is our Josephine Butler, also is on staff at Lycoming College. Have I got that right? Anyway, she reached out to her network and said, we're looking for a young woman of Indian descent who is interested in theater, and was able to find Mukta Fatik, who lives in the Upper West Side of Manhattan, is a theater person, a playwright, actor, and got introduced to me. We had a chat on the phone just talking about theater and community theater. And she said, you know, I got to admit, I'm kind of intrigued that you guys wanted to do this and you needed an Indian actor. You know, so, you know, I said, well, let's read together, see what that's like. See if you hate me or not. Maybe you never want to step into a theater with me. But no, I passed the test and she did really well. So we just figured out how could we do this? Because you live over 4 hours away. So yeah, we had a full week, the Priyapalooza, where we rehearse every scene she's in again and again and again and again and again.
When you finished the first incarnation of, what did you hear from people who saw the production? What about the impact of the piece? Did people report that they saw the situation of the Sherlock Holmes stories in a wonderfully fresh way that affected them? Gabe?
Yeah, so when we did Miss Holmes, I said, okay, one of two things is going to happen. You know, all the Sherlock Holmes fans are going to come out and then they're going to be mad. This isn't Sherlock Holmes. This is... And then, of course, the other camp might be, okay, why women? Why do we got to watch this play where the characters are women? Am I supposed to learn an important lesson? So I'm very pleased to announce nobody said either of these things. I think people just went, it's Sherlock Holmes and Watson. This is exactly what I was hoping for. And then folks who wanted to dive a little more deeply into the, when they talked to me about it, it was just like, you know, wait, was that true? Was that part true? Like, yeah, that part was true. Like, oh, I did not know that. But I personally, I want to tell a story, a really good story. And while I am completely excited about all the different sort of themes that Christopher Walsh has worked into this play, if it's not a good story, it's not going to, in my opinion, have any impact. My hope is that people will come and see this and at the end go, wow, that was so amazing, and this and that was so great. And what is that true? That really legally they could do that? Really, a woman could be held? Really, if your parents are foreign, you the people they work for own their savings account? Is that really a thing? Just sort of think about, I hope that the audiences will think about how differences separate us artificially. But the strength of our main characters and the characters that make it through to the end, their strength is their empathy, which brings them together.
Sound right, Sarah.
I think that I love history. I love learning. And so I very much resonate with Gabe wanting that sort of reaction from audiences. And I also agree that unless the story is good, unless the characters are believable and it's coming from, you know, genuine feeling on the part of the actors, you're not going to relate in the same way, and you may not buy in as well. So that puts the pressure on us as a cast and director to present something that people can relate to, that people will enjoy.
And Nikki, you started out by saying that you were attracted initially because you do feel strongly about women's issues, and exploring them through this must be one way of coming to terms with issues like the historical ones that Gabe just laid out. And how about that sense that we get of women in Victorian England and reverberations for us today still?
I especially enjoy seeing the strong women in this play buck the system and do what they know how to do best and do it well. And the fact that they are there to help and draw forward any other women who need them. These are the cases that other people won't help with. The police won't help with. So then there was this resource, this strength of these two characters being able to help them really spoke to me. And I see that in today's age as well. I mean, I owned a business for 20 years and I made it my personal. I really wanted to help all of the people that worked for me. I wanted to make sure that they did the best that they could do and use whatever strength that I had, whatever resources I had to help them grow to the next step in their lives. And so I just found that so refreshing. You know, at times it's sad. It's heart-wrenching to see what women went through throughout history and how hard we had to fight to get what we have today. And it just shows that we always need to be working towards bettering ourselves and society. And I think that both of these shows reflect that.
Gabe, tell us the particulars, where and when.
So Miss Holmes Returns will be opening on Valentine's Day, February 14th. We'll be performing the 14th and the 15th at 7:30 p.m., then the 21st and 22nd at 7:30 p.m., and the 23rd we'll have a matinee performance at 2:30. All performances at the Warehouse Theater right here in Willsboro. And I should mention, seeing as I've mentioned Valentine's Day, nobody has touched upon the fact that Sherlock Holmes finds herself the subject of some romantic interest in this play. And there's a whole other element for Sherlock to go, well, at first it's like, no, 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 no. Yeah, I'm not going to, it's there, yes. And on Valentine's Day only, we're offering a special Valentine's cocktail to our audience members so they can all toast to love. It's a Valentine's Day gimlet.
This is just an afterthought, but don't we know Raymond Chandler's Detective Philip Marlowe for drinking gimlets? Perfect.
So HamiltonGibson.org is Hamilton Gibson's website. Up at the top, you'll see tickets. Click on that. You'll find Miss Holmes Returns, and then the clicking is all you need. Just click away, folks. Click away.
Gabe Hochvacht, director
and actors Nikki York, who has the role of Sherlock Holmes, and Sarah Elswick, who plays Dr. Dorothy Watson. It's Hamilton Gibson Productions' presentation of Miss Holmes Returns by Christopher M. Walsh, opening February 14th, playing 14th, 15th, 21st, and 22nd at 7:30 p.m., and then February 23rd, a matinee at 2:30, at the Warehouse Theater in Wellsboro, 3 Central Avenue. The audience is invited, as we just heard, to an opening night reception just following the February 14th performance. We have a chance to check out the website and find all that we need, hamiltongibson.org, hamiltongibson.org, and that's Hamilton Gibson Productions presenting Miss Holmes Returns by Christopher M. Walsh this weekend and next, February 14th, 15th, 21st, and 22nd at 7:30 each night, and February 23rd, a matinee at 2:30, the Warehouse Theater, 3 Central Avenue in Wellsboro. For more information, hamiltongibson.org, hamiltongibson.org.